From NPR News, this is Weekend Edition. I'm Leanne Hansen. The 1987 movie Wall Street tells a story of an ambitious young stockbroker, played by Charlie Sheen, who's seduced into joining a big insider trading operation. But the most memorable character by far is the high-powered corporate raider he goes to work for, a man named for a lizard, Gordon Gekko. The part won Michael Douglas an Academy Award. In this week's installment of In Character, our series exploring the origins and impact of famous American fictional characters, we turn the spotlight on Gekko. As conceived by director Oliver Stone, Gekko is a slimy embodiment of all that was wrong with American capitalism. But as NPR's Jim Zaroli reports, the response to the character wasn't quite what Stone intended.
When we meet Gordon Gekko, he's pacing around his glitzy Manhattan office in front of a long row of computer screens, barking orders and juggling phone calls.
Looks as good as on paper. We're in the kill zone, pal. We're lock and load. Lunch? Oh, you gotta be kidding. Lunch is for wimps.
As he talks, he takes his own blood pressure, a cigarette in his mouth. Meanwhile, he's interviewing stockbroker Bud Fox, who's come to pay homage. Gekko is a lion of the business world, an alpha male famous for his cunning and financial acumen. He's 10 steps ahead of everyone. There's a smirk on Gekko's face as if he's reading your thoughts and knows your worst impulses. The devil wears silk suits. As Fox discovers, he is also a major league crook who trades in insider information and manipulates markets the way other people make conversation.
Tell Dodge shooting up. Did you buy any for yourself?
No, sir. That wouldn't have been legal.
Sure. Relax, pal. No one's going to blow the whistle on you.
Soon, Fox is lured into his operation, a junior partner in crime. He's got qualms about what he's doing, but Gekko says if he really wants to make it, he's got to put them aside.
Wake up, will you, pal? If you're not inside, you are outside, okay? And I'm not talking about some $400,000 a year working Wall Street stiff, flying first class and being comfortable. I'm talking about liquid. Rich enough to have your own jet. Rich enough not to waste time. $50-100 million, buddy.
As conceived by Stone and screenwriter Stan Weiser, Gekko is a larger-than-life composite of some of the fallen financiers from the insider trading scandals of the 1980s, like Mike Milken and Ivan Boesky. The movie poses a question. Why did men who were already rich beyond measure try to increase their fortune by cheating? For Gordon Gekko, who likes to quote from Sun Tzu's The Art of War, business isn't just business, it's a battle, a Darwinian showdown, and money is how you keep score. Wall Street veteran Ken Lipper was a technical advisor on the film.
The Gordon Gekko character is not a person who is satisfied by anything for very long. There's no permanent accomplishment. There is no peace until everyone else is a failure.
I don't like losses, boy. Nothing ruins my day more than losses. Now, you do good, you get perks. Lots and lots of perks.
Wall Street was meant as a cautionary tale about business ethics, but there's a paradox in the movie. As played by Michael Douglas, Gekko is one in a long line of lovable movie rogues, dashing and handsome in his suspenders and slicked back hair.
Gekko is glamorous in the way that many confidence men are glamorous.
George David Smith is a business historian who teaches at NYU's Stern School.
He's slick, he's quick-witted. He can be charming, and he can also be ruthless. And the movie does a very good job, I think, in presenting the sort of the macho world of Wall Street as it was at the time.
Screenwriter Stephen Schiff says before Gekko came along, Hollywood usually depicted businessmen as fat, poorly aging ogres doing shadowy things.
The idea that Gekko was this shiny, beautifully dressed, magnetic, charismatic superstar suited a lot of people in the business world very nicely.
Schiff says this is also the weakest thing about the movie. Although Bud Fox ultimately turns against him and Gekko heads to jail, the character's charisma undercuts the film's moralizing.
Who do you want to be coming out of the movie? Do you want to be Bud Fox, broken and downtrodden and never having quite made it? Or do you want to be Gordon Gekko, who, yeah, he's going to go to jail, but what a swashbuckler he was until that very last moment.
Both Douglas and Stone have said that a lot of young people they meet even see Gecko as a role model, and it has a lot to do with the film's most famous scene. Gecko shows up at a shareholders' meeting of a company he wants to take over. He's not trying to destroy the company, he says. He's trying to liberate it.
The point is, ladies and gentlemen, that greed, for lack of a better word, is good. Greed is right. Greed works. Greed clarifies, cuts through, and captures the essence of the evolutionary spirit. Greed.
Of course, Gecko doesn't want to save the company. He wants to strip its assets and sell them. But what gets remembered is his very persuasive and unapologetic defense of raw capitalism. But NYU's Smith says anyone who sees Gecko as some sort of capitalist hero is missing the point, because what Gecko does violates free market principles.
But what Gecko is doing is he's trying to monopolize information, trade on it, and in the process even fabricate information in order to manipulate the market to his own ends.
Smith also believes Gecko would have more trouble operating today because regulators pursue that kind of manipulation more aggressively. And in fact, audiences may get a chance to see how Gecko would fare in today's economy. A sequel to Wall Street is in the works. Oliver Stone isn't involved, but Michael Douglas has agreed to star. The movie's title will be Money Never Sleeps. Jim Zaroli, NPR News.
What great American characters inspire you? Nominate your favorites on our In Character blog. Go to npr.org/incharacter. We may put your suggestion on the radio. It's award season in Hollywood. The Grammys were a week ago, and next week it's the big event, the Academy Awards. Jake Halpern, author of the book Fame Junkies, introduces us to the people who get the stars ready for the spotlight, their assistants.
Not long ago, I attended a meeting of the Association of Celebrity Personal Assistants, or the ACPA. I'm not making this up. In fact, once a month, the group gathers at a restaurant in L.A. to discuss the unique challenges of its profession. "This place is like a support group," explained a young man who introduced himself to me as the former assistant to Dom DeLuise. "I was with Dom for 3.5 years, but it was time to go," he explained. "It's like any relationship. It's very personal. You know their lives and their private pains, and when you leave, it's like a breakup." The ACPA also hosts a semi-regular training seminar for aspiring assistants at a hotel in Los Angeles.
"Welcome to the 40th time we've given this class. We're not going to be able to tell you by the end of the evening how to be a celebrity."
That's Rita Tateel. Tateel describes herself as a celebrity recruiter, someone who gets stars to show up at various fundraisers and red carpet events. She claims to be someone who knows celebrities and their needs intimately. Tateel delivers her patented drill sergeant speech.
"You know, and if you do find yourself sick, guess what? You're still going to be working. Because it's not the kind of situation, unless it's pre-planned in advance in terms of vacation time, you know, where your employer is going to be able to just have his life just, you know, stop for a day because you're sick."
The bottom line, she concludes, is that you need to be available to serve your celebrity's every need. And above all, you must banish the word no from your professional vocabulary. On top of that, assistants are not paid particularly well. According to a survey administered by the ACPA, the average salary of a celebrity personal assistant is $56,000. Not all that much money by Hollywood standards, especially given the around-the-clock obligations that many of them have. After class, I chatted with one of the assistants, whose name is Dean Johnson, and he confessed that he isn't exactly sure where his job is leading him. Often being an assistant is not a means to an end, but an end itself. "Part of the reason this is true," says Dean, "is that many celebrities don't want to promote their assistants and, say, offer them a spot as an associate producer on one of their shows." "Why not?" "Simple," says Dean. "Just put yourself in your celebrity shoes. If you lost your assistant, then you'd have to hire someone else to run your life, and they might not get everything exactly right. Or, worse yet, they might say the dreaded two-letter word. No."
Jake Halpern is the author of the book Fame Junkies. This is NPR News.
Good morning, I'm Renee Montaigne. It was victory for the underdog, and we do mean underdog, at yesterday's Westminster Kennel Club Dog Show. The coveted Best in Show went to a breed that has never won the honor, the Beagle. Until now, the dog with floppy ears and big brown eyes was best known from the comic pages. Now perhaps Snoopy can share a celebratory bay with the Best in Show Beagle, whose name, by the way, is Uno. When striking writers and studios reached a deal earlier this week, we talked to a TV writer about what it means now that the 14-week strike is over. This morning we hear from the other side, one of the 8 CEOs in charge of Hollywood's major studios. We drove the 5 long blocks, this is L.A., from our studios in Culver City to the headquarters of Sony Pictures. There, inside a tastefully appointed, rather large study, we sat down with Michael Linton, who is the CEO of Sony Pictures Entertainment. He managed to squeeze us in during a hectic day of meetings.
It already feels busier, very much so. Everybody's schedules are all at once filled, and everybody's, you know, dusted off the cobwebs and gone back at it.
Sony was forced to put on hold one of next year's big movies, Angels and Demons, with Tom Hanks, the prequel to The Da Vinci Code.
It got delayed. That's absolutely right.
As an example of what a studio might do, how soon can that now go into production?
Hopefully it'll go into production quite quickly now over the next few months. So to the extent to which the picture was delayed, that's one effect of the strike, yes.
You know, a lot of mornings I would drive by the studio and see picketers out front.
Yeah,
dozens
me too.
Of them. What's it like now that they're back? I mean, there was a fair amount of bitterness.
In many respects, what you were describing in terms of the picket line, you would see when you went out and to one of my kids' soccer games, or for that matter, when you went to a restaurant, you saw the same people potentially who were picketing, and many of them are friends. And so I don't think I ever saw a real degree of acrimony. And not even really tension. I think there was a general lack of comfort on both sides with how the situation could get itself resolved, because there didn't seem to be a clear path to get there for the longest time.
Yeah, the key to making a deal, if I may say so.
Yeah, sure.
Correct me if I'm wrong. Was the decision to give the writers a cut of internet earnings. This was a big sticking point. It was a demand of the writers. How did the Alliance of Motion Pictures and Television Producers come around to a formula that worked for them?
There was a lot at stake, not least of which it's a very dynamic area, very fluid, and nobody quite knows where it is going. So I think on the one hand, they've built into it a lot of flexibility, including this idea that the whole agreement sort of sunsets after 3 years, so we can revisit the situation.
What do you see online or new media revenues happen? You know, how big do you expect them to be
The crystal ball of the internet is a very, very difficult one to discern. People who for one moment seem to be winners, next moment aren't. I mean, nobody expected Google to be where it is today as compared to Yahoo, for example. And nobody expected AOL to be where it is today. Everybody misjudged, for example, how quickly broadband would hit the market. For the longest time, everybody was sitting on a dial-up connection, and however long that was the case, video going through the internet was not a viable thing. All of a sudden, broadband really started getting traction in U.S. homes, and the next thing you know, video actually does become a viable thing, and we see that in something like YouTube. Whether that stays on the PC or that eventually goes to the television in the room, and how people start viewing video that's not just 10-minute clips or less, meaning full-length movies or television shows, is anyone's guess. So we don't know yet, is the answer.
Is it not part of your job description, in a way, to be able to look into that crystal ball and see what's ahead?
Absolutely. And the way that we try and plan for that is we tend to put down a lot of markers, meaning you will try and distribute a movie over the internet, make sure that it can be seen on a cell phone if that actually turns into a viable platform. We try subscription services. You know, Netflix now has a digital piece. We've done things with AOL. And at the end of the day, you see what works, and whatever works, you drill down and you do more of it. That's not to say it's a complete shotgun. I mean, there's lots of things we say no to, but by the same token, it's not a rifle shot, because you don't actually know what is going to work. The trick is always to make sure that when you see that something isn't working, to stop it, and when something is working, to accelerate that.
Thank you very much for talking with us.
It's a pleasure.
Michael Linton is chairman and CEO of Sony Pictures Entertainment.